Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. Today's episode is Closing Thoughts. This is going to be our fifth and final episode in the special series of episodes we've done to cover Adnan's PCR appeal hearing. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I blog at splitthemoon.com. I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Susan is an associate at the Volkov Law Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs at The View from LL2. And Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at the Evidence Prof blog. Now, in our past four episodes, we've gone over the 4 days of the appeal hearing that took place just last month. Today, we'll close out the series on the PCR with day five, all of which was devoted to closing arguments by both sides. Now, I had been sitting at the Dunkin' Donuts since the previous week, but on this final day of closing arguments, I was finally able to get into court. In case you don't remember, I had been sequestered because the prosecutor, Thiru Vignaraja, had argued to the court that he might call me as a witness. Well, he never did, and he had never even put me on any witness list before the hearing, but maybe he slept just a little bit better, having kept me out of the courtroom just for the heck of it. Nonetheless, the hearing now was over, so I got to join the others to see how both sides would close out their arguments for Judge Welch. Justin Brown, Adnan's attorney, began the day with his closing arguments. And it was interesting because he started off by saying something that probably had been bothering him for the last few days. He realized that things had gotten heated in the courtroom more than once. From what I heard, there were quite a few very dramatic moments. So he started off by thanking the court for the court's patience because things got heated. He also did something else that really almost moved me to tears. He went behind Adnan and put his hands on his shoulders and he said, "I am here because I am proud to represent this man." Now, he wanted to call the court's attention to two witnesses that he thought were emblematic of this hearing, that represented how this entire hearing and maybe even how this entire case have been going. Now, the two contrasting witnesses that he wanted to point out were Officer Steve, the security guard that was called by the state, and his own witness, Ms. Hamill, the librarian. And this is what he wanted to point out. He pointed out that he called Ms. Hamill because she was called to testify for a single fact. She only was going to testify about the cameras in the library because she was employed at the time. She was in charge of the cameras, and she could put an actual date on when the cameras existed in the library. Now, he wanted to contrast that with Officer Steve, who, although he admitted, was brave enough to admit when he was wrong, but basically, when he was called to the stand by the state, he testified that he wasn't really sure whether or not there were cameras in the library. There might have been, and they might not have been. I think it was a really brilliant move by Justin to open up his closing remarks with this contrast because he's right. Almost all of the witnesses that Justin presented were there to testify to very specific facts, facts that they were absolutely sure of. And in contrast, much of the state's case centered around things that might or might not have been, things that were possible but maybe not. So in a way, here, Officer Mills actually became a great witness for the defense, which Justin also pointed out. Now, another thing that Justin wanted to talk about was that he wanted to get right to the issue of the cell phone evidence, meaning the fax cover sheet. And he knew that in their closing remarks, the state was going to make a specific argument. Justin anticipated that the state was going to make the argument that Adnan had essentially waived the Brady claim on the cell cover sheet. And the reason for that is this. The state was probably going to make the argument that the defense had this fax cover sheet in their files for many years. Justin had the files himself for at least 7 years, 7 or 8 years since he's been representing Adnan. And so there is no Brady defense, right? Because the state has disclosed the document and the defense has the document. But Justin wanted to head that argument off because he wanted to explain to the court that that is not how this works. How it works is this, that it wasn't until Justin and his cell phone expert, Jerry Grant, spoke to Abe Woronowitz, the expert who testified at the trial, it wasn't until then that everybody realized that Abe had never seen this document, that this document had been withheld from him when he was going to testify. So he put Abe's affidavit up on the overhead projector and he pointed out the date that they spoke and the date that Abe made the affidavit and said, "This is the date the defense was made to be on notice. This is the point at which we realize that a Brady offense had occurred back in 1999.
Right, and that's because Adnan had made a Brady claim, and the nature of a Brady claim is that the defense wouldn't have been aware of the issue because the prosecution had either failed to disclose evidence or done so in a misleading manner. And this goes to the briefing by Thiru, where he himself is making the argument that Exhibit 31 is not a subscriber activity report. And my understanding is that based upon that, Justin requested documents from the state, and through cross-referencing various documents was finally able to figure out exactly what was going on. And that seems to be the argument he's making here, which is to say that this can't be waived because you can't argue statute of limitations when it's the state who has prevented this argument from being raised before.
Justin then talked about the experts in the case, the ones who testified about the cell phone evidence. He told the court that we'd heard from two witnesses, Jerry Grant and Chad Fitzgerald, and Justin asked the court to recall the nature of how they testified. Justin pointed out that Grant had said frequently, "Well, I don't know about that. I cannot speculate on the reasons. I don't know for sure. Here's what I do know, and here's what we can figure out, and here's what I've seen and how this should apply here." But for these other questions he was asked about, Grant would say, "I do not know about that. I've tried to determine it, and this point cannot." In contrast, Justin said, he can't say the same for Chad Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald would not answer a single question that Justin asked unless he thought it helped the state. Again and again, Fitzgerald would simply dodge a question or answer a question that wasn't asked. And it's only when he thought that Justin's question was one that he could answer in a way that helped Thiru's case that he actually gave a straightforward answer. And then Justin said that all happened until he thought he'd got tricked. And at that point, Fitzgerald reacted the way everyone in court saw. He said everything that Justin would have liked to say in closing, probably, but, you know, Fitzgerald put it better than he could have. And that was that you do not give an expert incomplete documentation and ask them to give testimony based on an incomplete record, especially in the case of relevant instructions about how to interpret cell phone records. And as Justin told the court, the truth is something is wrong here. Something is wrong with these incoming calls, and that should have been known at the time of trial and could have easily been known at the time of trial. Had the state's own expert known about what AT&T had said about the reliability of these records, he would have told the court that he could not affirm the state's interpretation of them. Now, Fitzgerald's explanation for why that cover sheet was there was that it had to do with switches, even though, as Fitzgerald acknowledged, switches would not have been used for location in the sense that it was used at this trial and in the sense that he would typically use it in almost every case. If you're using cell phone records to determine or estimate a phone's location at the time of a call, you're not using the switch. So to apply the AT&T cover sheet to that part of the records doesn't make sense because AT&T knows what the cops are going to use this for. They know why the state wants these records. And it would make perfect sense that the language that seems to directly apply to that use does in fact apply to that use. And then Justin summed up like some of the more colorful exchanges he and Fitzgerald had about the subscriber activity records and whether or not they were subscriber activity records. And then Fitzgerald's eventual admission, yes, they are subscriber activity records. He just prefers to use different terms. And then, of course, there's the helicopter call. And as Justin said, that's a problem. That's a huge problem. It shows something in this report is wrong. And Justin summed up by saying, here's one of those square pegs I mentioned and how the state's trying to put it into a round hole. But no matter how much and how hard the state tries, it's just not going to fit. We can argue until we're blue in the face, but what it all comes back to is that Wernowitz took the stand in the year 2000, and he had not seen the full documentation. He received Exhibit 31 in court the day he testified, but was not given time to study it and was never given a copy of the cover sheet. Justin said, they hung him out to dry. They put Wernowitz up on the stand unprepared, and they put him in an awkward situation. Wernowitz was a very diligent engineer, and he was concerned with doing a good job. If he'd been given these documents at the time of his testimony, yes, it would have changed it, because these documents do matter. They do affect what he testified to, and he would have wanted to make sure that his testimony was accurate. He was deprived of that opportunity to do so, and that is why this issue was before the court at the PCR hearing, along with the alibi issue. Then Justin, I was going to say took a jab, but that's not a fair characterization. He just simply addressed the fact that there's that really concerning footnote from the state's brief before the Court of Appeals. Justin said, the state's methods of attack were creative, clever, and pointed, but their facts simply don't add up together. Although they try to argue that the aged alibi, the phone calls, none of that matters because they could change their timeline, and that isn't how this works.
And that footnote was the footnote that in the brief, the state said that they would have made the come and get me call the 3:15 p.m. call, right?
Yeah, which Collins addressed in detail, but it's not that simple. You can't just substitute one timeline for another, especially not an appeal like this. In fact, as Collins has pointed out, there is extensive case law in Maryland which addresses this very topic, and the case law is clear. This is not a point in dispute. This is black letter law in Maryland. You cannot simply avoid a question under Strickland by saying, oh, it's okay, the state could have changed its whole case, and therefore this alibi wouldn't have mattered anyway.
Yeah, that was the Griffin case, the Fourth Circuit case, out of the same court where there was a shooting slash robbery at a Rite Aid. And as the state presented the case at trial, the defendant had an alibi if his defense counsel had contacted an alibi witness. And then on appeal, the state made the exact same claim that Thurin made in that footnote in the brief, which was to say, well, actually, we could have changed the timeline because one of the security guards actually said the robbery was about 15 minutes earlier. And based upon the location of the alibi witness's house, that means that actually he could have committed that robbery and then had enough time to get to the house. And the Fourth Circuit flatly rejected that and said, that doesn't matter. We're looking at the facts presented at trial. It's a time capsule, and you're looking at what the alibi witness would have done under the reasonable timeline presented by the state at trial.
And at some points, I couldn't keep up with Justin when he was reciting case law. I got down some of them. I got down Griffin. He did mention that one. He got down Grooms versus Salem. And I got four or five more down here. But again, there were so many cases that Justin cited that, you know, I missed some of them. In contrast, I heard the state cite exactly one case. And that's Klebecki. Klebecki, Klebecki, Klebecki. It's all they ever talked about because they only had that case. And that wasn't even about the Asia issue. So in terms of case law, I just think from presentation alone, it was made abundantly clear to the judge that the case law is on Justin's side. Thurin would have cited cases if he'd had them. Problem is, he just didn't. When Justin talked about Asia, he stuck to the facts very closely. He explained what was established beyond a shadow of a doubt, what we knew, what we could show definitely happened, and what we knew for sure about how Gutierrez handled the Asia issue, which isn't too much because she simply ignored it for the most part. But she has some notes, and those notes do show that no later than July 13th, 1999, Gutierrez was on notice of Asia McClain. She knew that Asia was an alibi witness because the defendant had told her so. And at that point, as I think Justin put it, Gutierrez is driving the bus. She is the one responsible for Asia not being contacted, full stop. Although Thurin tried to complicate matters by making it this massive conspiracy or massive, I don't know, shared incompetence, it's not about what happened with every attorney that's ever seen Anand's case. It's about the attorney who represented him from April, a month after he was arrested, until the end of his second trial. She was the one who knew about Asia. She was the one who had the duty to contact her, and she's the one who failed to do so. And no, we don't know exactly why Gutierrez failed to contact her, because there probably wasn't a why. It was probably just like everything else happened with Gutierrez then, just incompetence and the wheels falling off the bus. Because at the end of the day, mistakes were made, and these mistakes, had they not been made, could have turned Anand's trial around. Justin said that Gutierrez wanted to win. She was a fighter. She would have done everything she could to help Anand had she had the physical ability to do so. But something was wrong. There were too many signals, too many flags. Something was really, really wrong with Gutierrez, not just in 99, but in the year or two before and certainly afterwards. And he talked about the witnesses that the defense brought on. Dante, Kanishwar, even Irwin, who also had known her and seen her performance in her prime. And as the two attorneys who'd worked with her testified, she'd fallen apart. The problems didn't start in 2000. They'd started before, they were real, they were concerning. And that is why, to answer the judge's question from the very not even the first day of the hearing, from before the first day of the hearing. That is why Asia was never contacted. Not because there was a problem with her, not because there was a strategy behind it, because Gutierrez was sick and not doing her job and unable to understand her own limitations at that point, by all appearances.
Yeah, by the way, following up on that, we had discussed the Griffin case before. There's an interesting parallel between this case and that case because Griffin, that alleged Rite Aid robber, his initial attorney had done a good deal of work in the case, and then he was disbarred for the same reasons, primarily as Gutierrez, that he had commingled funds, not done work, etc. And so his new attorney took over, and he relied upon the work done by Griffin's first attorney, went through the file, relied upon the witnesses he contacted, and relied upon the advice of that first counsel, which was, this will just be an easy guilty plea. There's no way he's going to fight the charges at trial. And that's the reason why, in that case, he didn't contact the alibi witnesses. So that's interesting in the sense that part of Theroux's argument is that there could have been some type of reasonable reliance upon maybe, possibly, hypothetically, what prior attorneys did. Again, Griffin, that case, which originates out of the same court here, same factual context, and the court there says he couldn't rely upon what the prior attorney did. He had a duty on his own to independently contact and investigate these alibi witnesses.
Towards the end, Justin said, I want to talk about the defense file, because the state is arguing, or will continue to argue, that Gutierrez's file shows an attorney who was on top of her game, who was competent and effective. But as Justin pointed out, incidentally, we are not hearing this from any witnesses. We only heard it from cross-examination questioning. But the questions of an attorney are not evidence. Fear wishes they were, and that was, aside from Fitzgerald, it was the entirety of his case. But as Justin said, if Theroux was going to argue that the file is proof of Gutierrez's competence, then let's get someone up there to say it other than Theroux himself.
Yeah, I remember that was a really excellent point. It was really strong that he just nailed it, that there wasn't a single witness presented by the state to back up any of their allegations.
If the defense file is proof of competence and effectiveness in an attorney who was doing her job, then let's get that person to tell the court about what that file was like. Let's get a person who can testify about competency of attorneys. Let's get them on the stand. Let's not have Theroux ask questions during cross and call that evidence. And I'm not even sure where this happened, but at one point Theroux brought up the idea of alibi through cross-examination, saying that's what Gutierrez did. She put on an alibi through cross-examination of the state's witnesses. And that was kind of what Theroux was doing. Not an alibi, but he was putting on a case through cross-examination. He was trying to prove the competence of Gutierrez, not by putting on his own evidence, but simply by cross-examining the defense's witnesses. It was about as effective as Gutierrez's supposed alibi through cross-examination strategy was.
And this is interesting because we talked last episode about the expert witness disclosure that was submitted by Theroux for Fitzgerald in this case. We know in this case that part of that disclosure as well was for Billy Martin to testify as an expert for the state. And that disclosure essentially said that Martin would say that Gutierrez was effective and he would rebut the claims by the defense team that she was ineffective in the case. And I wonder, because we had the whole discussion about Theroux creating that language without Fitzgerald having looked at the documents, I wonder whether something similar happened here, because obviously Martin was never called as a witness. I wonder whether Theroux wrote this disclosure before giving the files to Martin. He had a look at them and realized there's no way I can take the witness stand and under oath say that this was an effective job by Gutierrez.
So before, I know a lot of people really curious what Billy Martin was going to say, because I couldn't really imagine him getting up there and saying, oh, it's fine not to contact an alibi witness. I wouldn't do that in this case, because he's a practicing attorney. He's not going to announce to potential clients in the whole world that he thinks it's okay not to talk to an alibi witness.
And he's also a very highly reputable attorney. He's not just, he's very well known.
Yeah, so that's not what he was going to say. And then when we heard from Fitzgerald and about how he'd gotten brought onto the case and how he hadn't actually looked at any files before that expert notice was filed, yeah, Colin, what you said makes sense. That could explain why Martin never showed up, because he talked to Theroux, got Theroux's version of events and said, okay, yeah, no, that sounds like something I can testify to. So Theroux went ahead and filed the expert designation. And then if Martin saw the files himself, maybe that's why he didn't make an appearance. On the other hand, and we talked about this also as well, Colin, it could have to do with the fact that the only thing Martin could have actually testified to is perhaps materiality, and perhaps tried to argue that, okay, yes, it was ineffectiveness, but in this case, it would not have been material because it wouldn't have changed the outcome. But Theroux couldn't have done that because that would have opened Pandora's box, so to speak.
Yeah, it would have opened Pandora's box because you imagine the only people who could answer that question would be Yurik and Murphy, and you really would need one of them to come in and say, here are all the moving parts in the case, and okay, let's assume Asia McLean testifies, she sees it not until 2:40. That means we're having to shift the come and get me call to 3:15, because that's the cornerstone of the state's case, which would then allow for Justin on cross-examination to basically lay bare every single issue with trying to move that to 3:15, whether it be the Nisha call, whether it be Inez's testimony, whether it be what Debbie said about when she talked to Hay at 3:00 that day. So, right, exactly. It was almost a matter of there might be some good that could have come of it, but as you say, Pandora's box, there could have been some really terrible consequences for the state if they tried to make that argument.
If Theroux could have found an attorney who could have testified in any way remotely favorable to him, he would have used that attorney. He couldn't. He needed an expert. His failure to call one wasn't a strategy. It was simply a reflection of reality. It wasn't an option here because there is no attorney you're going to find other than Theroux himself who's willing to get up there and say that, oh yeah, Gutierrez did a fantastic job here. One of the better sections of Justin's closing, or one that I thought was really useful given the context of the hearing, was to highlight for the judge exactly what Theroux was arguing. Because at the end of the day, yes, the hearing went on 5 days, but a large percentage of that was just about Theroux's hypotheticals. It was a battle about Theroux throwing out some conjecture and the defense going, well, that makes no sense because XYZ. And the case law is clear. You cannot offer up conjecture and call it a strategic decision. Theroux cannot simply say, well, here's a possible reason for why Gutierrez did this, therefore that's a strategy. You have to have evidence of a strategy. And you can't just speculate, you can't just guess. And that's all Theroux did all day long, was guess and speculate and theorize. Because you can always come up with something. You can always say, oh, Gutierrez, actually, she was a precog. And she knew that calling Asia would not have worked out well, so that was a very strategic decision in not calling her. And every single reason that Theroux laid out, it was speculation. It was based on cryptic references to notes in a file. I mean, at the hearing, Theroux spent a lot of time coming up with new stories and new conjecture, all in an attempt to explain why Gutierrez didn't simply pick up a phone and call the witness. According to Theroux, Gutierrez was reasonable and somehow tracking down all kinds of obscure facts about class schedules and Anon's class schedule, Asia's class schedule, the library's location, the library's, like, the timing of when a security guard was there, all kinds of things. But really, an attorney who was actually being strategic and looking at how to put on a defense for a client, she would pick up the phone and call the witness. There's no reason not to. It answers all your questions quickly. It covers all your bases. You can't go wrong that way. It's simpler, it's quicker, it's more effective. There is no reason for a strategic and competent attorney to do these mental gymnastics instead of simply saving herself a whole lot of trouble and time and calling Asia. And Denny pointed out that Theroux was making a lot of fairly questionable arguments, and fairly questionable is a mild way of putting it. I have in my notes, when he was talking about the Juwan issue, Justin said that Theroux's argument comes down to, quote, there was something sneaky there. And I just did the air quotes right now because this is a podcast and apparently I forgot that. So Theroux just makes things look nefarious through his presentation and calls that an aspect of Gutierrez's strategy. But Juwan himself put in the affidavit and said, no, it's not what's going on here, no. If there was actually something wrong here, if there's actually something that was problematic, Theroux would have investigated it. He would have done what he tried to do with the security guard and actually gone out and talked to Juwan. It's not like he couldn't have done that, but he knew actually talking to the witnesses would have hurt his case. Actually talking to the people involved or finding facts would have undermined all of his claims. So he avoided the facts, and instead he simply put on this ambiguous, obscure police note from a file that was never given to Gutierrez before trial and said, Your Honor, I'd like you to read this in a way that makes everything about the defense's case look as suspicious and evil as possible. I'm not going to put any evidence on to support it, but I think you should read it this way and just assume that it's actually as devilish as I'm suggesting. But again, if Thier was a good lawyer, if he could have had evidence to support this claim, he would have gone out and produced it to the court. Justin closed his closing by saying, I can't deny that Thier knows how to cross-examine. He crossed Asia until she cried. It was a sustained cross for 2 days, but she kept her credibility. But she was fantastic, and Your Honor saw it all. At the end of the day, do you put Asia McClain on the stand? Yes, you do. Your Honor, I am disappointed in the state's case. Two witnesses, one the security guard, and one was Chad Fitzgerald, who would not answer questions. There was no one up there to talk about Asia. There was no one up there to talk about whether it was reasonable for Gutierrez not to call her. And as Justin said, if you're going to say that it was strategic not to put Asia on the stand, put someone on the stand to say that. Put Billy Martin up there. Find me one attorney who will say that. I'd love to hear someone say that. Justin said, when I saw Billy Martin on the expert disclosure, I said, uh-uh, he's not going to say that. And that's what we were just talking about. Like, Billy Martin and no defense attorney, no attorney is going to make the case that Thier was trying to make. That's why, as we'll get to, Thier was the state's witness. The state didn't put on a case. Its case was the closing.
So after Justin wraps up, the court then turns to the state and asks Thier to present his closing arguments. And the state begins by saying, may it please the court, and puts a PowerPoint up which says the state versus Adnan Syed. And it's interesting because he puts it up, but then he immediately says he knows that that's not the right title, but it's how he thinks about the case.
I was wondering if that PowerPoint was a dig at us. I'm like, well, that's the name of our podcast. It's not the name of the case right here.
Oh, that's interesting. Actually, I can completely see that because I really feel like I'll be honest, because of the weakness of any legal argument that was presented, I feel like he just wasn't even addressing the court. It was just a big public ploy. And he opens his statements up with noting that there's a lot of publicity here, that, you know, don't let that sway you, judge. You made the right decision before, and, you know, it's gotten all this attention, shouldn't be treated differently. Yeah, why would he do that when he knows it's not the right title of the case right now?
It's a little paranoid, but it could be.
No, I think there's so many things that he says that come like directly from Reddit that I don't think that's beyond the scope of possibility at all. Yeah, definitely. He's definitely paying attention. I mean, he knows who you are. He had me sequestered. Of course he's paying attention.
But I am fairly sure he has not listened to Undisclosed, which is crazy.
Really?
Because if your opponent is putting out a podcast broadcasting like a lot of their plans.
Yeah.
Dude, I'd be all over that.
But why don't you think so? I think he absolutely could have and has nothing to counter it with. How could his performance have been any better if he had listened to Undisclosed? He still would have, there's nothing he could find that would have helped his case.
Well, he'd have known more of the facts of the case, which couldn't have hurt.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he might have if he had really, really paid attention. I mean, there's so much there. I think he had the case for like about 6 or 7 months. I don't know if he could have caught up with, and considering the other stuff he's doing. I mean, we have listeners who've listened to Undisclosed. I mean, they still don't remember everything that we've, they'll still be asking the same questions even though they've listened to it.
I ask the same questions even though I'm making a podcast. So.
I forget stuff too. So I think he listens. I don't know. So this is interesting. To me, I mean, Thier brings this up a couple of times, and even though I wasn't present for the entire hearing, I was only there for really the closing, I felt like I heard it a number of times. But what he says to the court, basically, it's almost like he's reassuring the court that, listen, you got it right the first time. Because remember, this is the same judge who denied the PCR a couple of years ago. So Thier says, you got it right the first time. There's a lot of publicity around the case. It's gotten a lot of attention. And that the state sees the wisdom in the Court of Appeals decision to remand in the interest of justice. It's good to clarify the record. It's almost like he's saying that, you know what, it's good. Let's just humor all these people because the case has gotten so much publicity. And that's, we're just all going through the motions here. That's fine. But Your Honor, you should stick to your previous decision. And, you know, he says what the state opposes is for Adnan Syed to have a second day in court because he was convicted 17 years ago before a jury of his peers, which means anybody who's been convicted by a jury of their peers should never get another chance in court, it seems, which is, of course, ridiculous. Now, he goes on to say that the prosecution marshaled a long list of witnesses that were deemed credible and truthful. After vigorous cross-examination, he, Adnan, was found guilty. And he's talking again about the trial. Then he goes on to talk about the fact that Gutierrez did put on a passionate and vigorous defense. And this is something he's going to bring up repeatedly about how well she did. And he's going to point to the defense files and all kinds of other things and how she tried so hard to get documents. And it was all a testament to her diligence and her competence. What the state is saying is that basically, if Adnan was convicted, it wasn't because his attorney didn't put on a vigorous defense. It was because there was overwhelming evidence that he committed the crime. And he acknowledges that that's hard for the state to say because he's aware that it's not the most popular position the state has taken. Now, if I'm understanding this correctly, what he's saying, Susan, is that it's not a popular position to say that there's overwhelming evidence that Adnan did it. Is that what he means here?
My take is that he was saying he knows that there's been a misguided popular effort to advance the defense's case, but despite the popular appeal, the state has a duty to stick to the facts and to abide by the truth, with the unsaid subtext of unlike podcasters.
He goes on to say that, you know, we now have an opportunity to restore a bit of faith in the system, an opportunity to put the factual and legal conclusions before the court again so the defendant will be satisfied that notwithstanding the vigorous defense put on by Justin Brown's team and Christina Gutierrez's team, it was a just result. And what is just is not always what's popular. Again, he's giving a nod to this idea that, listen, we're just kind of going through the motions because of all this popularity. And at the end of the day, we all know we're going to end up reaching the same result.
Oh, yeah. I like your note here, Rabia, about when talking about the file, because Theodore started saying at the previous hearing, Brown objected and presented only documents directly related to the hearing from the defense file. But now we have the whole file and we're grateful for the opportunity to view it, not because the state's curious to see if the defense was making legit arguments. We knew they were making good faith arguments. It's because the defendant waived privilege.
Maybe that was another dig, you think?
It was totally a dig. There's no other point to have that. But I didn't even get what he was trying to do. I mean, your note says, like, so basically the state wanted to see the file for the hell of it?
That's what he's saying. Then that's because once they got the defense file, and maybe, Colin, you should explain like how that happened and why that happened, that there was nothing in it. You're telling me that they weren't really looking at the file to find something? Of course they were. They were looking for evidence that, you know, Asia had been investigated and Gutierrez knew about the, well, you know, whatever. They were looking for evidence to support their arguments. When they didn't find it, they just turned it into a dig.
So the fact that he even blatantly says, oh, of course we trusted the defense not to make arguments that weren't true. No. Come on, Theroux. You were hoping to find something in there that goes, well, I talked to Asia today, but she lied to me, so I'm not going to call her to the stand.
If we want to actually believe what he's saying, I think that makes him look pretty bad. If you're just going to go through these types of motions, you know, and make things difficult for the defense, for the court has to rule on these issues for the hell of it. Yeah, that doesn't make you look real great. I mean, that's just frivolous.
Yeah, what I find interesting about the overall tenor of Theroux's argument is that I'm looking here at the main thrust of his argument, which is to say, we're having this debate and we're arguing X and the defense is arguing Y and the public is seeing Z. But then he says, one person saw every minute of the previous trial, Judge Hurd. And in this case, when Judge Hurd was making comments in court, she said, quote, both sides presented an admirable case. What's odd about that argument is there are, as I've mentioned before, two types of appeal. One is direct appeal, and then one is collateral appeal. Direct appeal, which is what Adnan had soon after his trial, is based upon errors that are apparent from the trial record. The very nature of a collateral appeal, which is what this is these are errors that are not apparent from the trial record. In other words, they're errors that the trial judge would not be aware of at all, such as failure to contact an alibi witness, failure to challenge cell tower evidence, the fact that the disclaimer was not given to the expert, et cetera. So this is a false argument. It would make a great deal of sense on direct appeal to say the judge saw everything and ruled against the defendant and said this was a great job. But on collateral appeal, it's completely irrelevant because the very nature of the argument is there's no way from the trial record you could tell that these errors took place.
Theroux knows that. He knows better. Why do you think that he's actually raising this as an issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right, is that he has seen this case framed a certain way to a vast swath of the public through serial, and he's upset because he feels as if it's an inaccurate representation. And as you say, he's arguing it to the court of public opinion, not to the court of Judge Welch, because Judge Welch knows full well, this being a collateral appeal, what the trial judge said about what happened inside that courtroom has no relevance whatsoever to the two claims being raised by Adnan.
Closing arguments aren't evidence, or they shouldn't be. So this isn't for the appeal, or if it is, it's a somewhat misguided strategy. It has to be for the public because I don't see any other point, really. So Theroux said, Gutierrez was known for being tenacious and meticulous and frustrating to state's attorneys. A lot of people in Maryland here know that. And for the defense to now smear her name, she would probably smile at that. She cared about her clients that much and would support their continued vigorous defense. But it isn't fair and it isn't based on the record before us. This part drove me crazy because Theroux's trying to score some moral points, saying how dare the defense smear Gutierrez's name. But Theroux himself smeared the name of four different attorneys, minimum, during the course of the hearing. Why is it fair for him to smear those attorneys who, you know, their representation not only is not before the court, there's no evidence they did a poor job. And he didn't just accuse them of being ineffective. He accused them of being unethical and trying to perpetrate a fraud upon the court. So it's about as disingenuous as it gets. And I have never seen a prosecutor or any attorney really get up in front of a court and just all throughout the hearing, just throw out claims that four different attorneys have committed unethical practices based on no fact whatsoever. And in a high profile case that's getting a lot of attention. No, that isn't fair. I mean, it's not effective either. So, I mean, Rabia, you're one of those attorneys. He was claiming that you had done some nefarious stuff with the defense files.
Yeah, no, I realize that. But you know what? I was a little bit shocked when I heard him use the word smear because, number one, the idea that raising a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, which happens all the time in many cases where attorneys make mistakes. And there are attorneys who admit to being ineffective, right? I mean, so this is not an issue of sometimes it's just it's a human error. But this kind of language about smearing her or that I might have like done something to defense files, which, you know, what happened with serial was it set it up in a way that people in their heads thought that somehow in the trunk of my dinky little Tercel, I had traveled for years with like 20 boxes of files. That's not at all what had happened. The files had always, they had been with the Don's attorneys and they had ended up in his parents' basement. And I had just copied like, I don't know, maybe three or four folders full of them 15 years ago. And that's what I had kept with me, like the documents I thought were the most important. The only time I saw them between the 15 years, you know, I had seen them previously and now was when I took Sarah to Adnan's home to retrieve them. Like I'd never touched them in the interim. But these are all ideas. I was just shocked because I'm like, oh my God, that's exactly like what they say on Reddit. So I just repeatedly keep getting shocked hearing the same things that I've been seeing on Reddit, the same kinds of allegations and accusations, because either he is getting these arguments directly from Reddit or he has come to like the exact same conclusions as them. But I also thought this was so disingenuous because, you know, he's talking about the record before us doesn't show that she was ineffective. He fought things that are before the court. He fought the inclusion of records from the Attorney Grievance Commission that would have shown the dozens of other clients who had filed complaints against her. He fought that. I don't know if this was brought up during the hearing, but I think he also opposed evidence of her physical condition, of her actual health. So he's saying that forget her health, forget like the 3-4 dozen other client complaints. Look at only like what's in this defense file. And it's so disingenuous because is he saying that like all of us are smearing her name? Or could it be that maybe 40 odd clients all suffered because this person wasn't effective for whatever reason while he fights hard to keep out all evidence of that? That's what pissed me off.
For me, trying to defend Gutierrez's representation of her clients at the end of her career as representative of her is smearing her name. To say that what she did at the end was who she was as an attorney is to take away the years she fought for her clients and was a capable attorney. And I have my notes here, and this I thought was just a flat out misstep by Theroux. He says, oh, Gutierrez is so competent. And he talks about all the ways in which she fought so hard to get documents and how many letters she wrote demanding the state hand over evidence and how many times she fought the state to get these records for her client. But at other parts in the closing and the hearing, he starts waxing, oh, look at our open file policy. She had all these documents. She had everything she needed. Well, if there's an open file policy, why the hell was it so hard for Gutierrez to get anything out of them? I mean, that's proof right there, and that comes from the state's own case, that there was no open file policy, and the state was playing hardball on handing over anything.
That's sort of the essence of everything in this case, which seems to be that Theroux was speaking out of both sides of his mouth and wanting to have it both ways. But you're exactly right. The nature of an open file policy is there shouldn't have to be any struggle. So which is it? You can't dangle both of these out there and use them for both purposes. Either the state did fight tooth and nail, and therefore in response, Gutierrez did fight tooth and nail, and that would be more indicative of a Brady violation, or it was an open file policy, and then Gutierrez was ineffective for some reason, fighting so hard and spending so much time trying to get these documents when they were readily available.
Then Theroux launched into a very, 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 very long recital of the facts of the case. And I think we should just skip over it because it doesn't add anything. And also it's factually incorrect a lot of the time.
It's just like the briefs that were submitted by the state in the last 6 months or year or whatever.
Yeah. And poor Krista. She was at this part of the hearing and she was once again Crystal.
She was still Crystal in this?
She was still Crystal.
Yeah. I mean, they were just like basic things that were wrong that, you know, that 2 weeks before she died, it became public. The relationship became public. I mean, there's some basic facts that are wrong. And then there's all the spin. There's a lot of spin. That the diary showed that the defendant was possessive, jealous, overprotective.
I have the margins written up top. This isn't a PCR closing. It's a one witness trial.
Yeah, I mean, and overall, there's one thing that Theroux can't change, and that is that at trial, they presented the uncontradicted testimony of Inez Butler Hendricks, who had Hay leaving school in a hurry between 2:15 and 2:20 p.m. I mean, the rest of the case is what it is, and you can debate one way or the other, but when you're dealing with an uncontacted alibi witness who consistently says she saw the defendant next to the school until 2:40 p.m., that's your case right there. That, on the prejudice prong, is the core of what you'd be deciding.
The reason he goes through this recital of facts is because he's trying to prove a point. What he's saying is this, because, you know, part of proving the ineffective assistance of Brady is to show that if these issues did not exist, that the outcome of the case would have been different. And what Theroux is saying is that, no, it wouldn't have mattered. That's the only reason I can see that he's going through all the facts. He's saying that there was overwhelming evidence anyway. So even if you had included Asia's testimony, which would have contradicted Jay's testimony, even if you had that fax cover sheet had been reviewed by the cell phone expert, it wouldn't have mattered. So essentially he's saying Jay's testimony and the cell phone evidence were not as important because there's so much other evidence that could have convicted Adnan anyways.
And he tried to argue that he went back to the we can change the timeline thing by saying, well, there was evidence at trial that Hay was alive and seen at school at 3 p.m. Therefore, Gutierrez would have known about this and not wanted to put on an alibi witness before 3 p.m. But to support this claim, he says there were witnesses that said they saw the victim at 3 p.m. and then names Becky and Inez.
Wrong and wrong.
Yeah.
Becky says she sees Hay leaving school in a hurry soon after 2:15. Inez says she sees her leaving school in a hurry between 2:15 and 2:20. It's Debbie who's the one who says she saw Hay at 3. But of course, Debbie, depending upon your version of the story, either says Hay was going to see Don or that Takara was in the conversation. Takara asked Hay for a ride. No one else did. And Hay said she didn't have time to give anyone else a ride. So I would have loved to have seen the state at trial trying to rely upon Debbie as the last person to see Hay alive, because there's reasonable doubt all over the place with Debbie's accounting of events. And as I've mentioned before, if you try to shift the come and get me call to 3:15, you lose all sorts of credibility in the state's case. The Nisha call goes out the window. the jurors have to reconcile why Becky and Inez are seeing Hay leaving much earlier in the day. It just creates so much confusion. That's exactly the nature of reasonable doubt. But I can see what Theora was trying to do, but I just don't see how it's a compelling or a convincing argument.
And Theora said that Gutierrez was considering arguing a 3 p.m. timeline and Asia would have ruined that. So her strategy was not to call Asia. But how? How does Asia ruin that?
Not at all. It's not as helpful if Hay's leaving school at 3 as if she's leaving school at 2:20 or so, but it doesn't hurt the defense case at all, certainly.
My favorite part of the closing, if I had to choose one, because there are a lot of favorite points, was that he puts up page from Gutierrez's notes, and he says, Gutierrez did her own analysis of the cell records. She knew what was going on. She knew how to understand things. And he puts up a copy of the January 13th, the call log from the defense file. She's typed it up and she's like put her notations there. And next to the 514 call, next to the voicemail call, the incoming call to voicemail, Gutierrez has lots of little question marks there because the tower names don't match anything she's seen before. And she has no idea what's going on. And Theora says, look, it's proof that she was analyzing things. It's proof that she knew that there was a problem with the switch here. I had my notes. And I don't know if this is right because it sounds so crazy. She was aware of switches that didn't have towers. Whatever was said there, it wasn't right. Because the point Theora was making was that the fact Gutierrez had question marks next to the voicemail cell towers is proof she knew what was happening. No. That is amazing proof right there that Gutierrez had never seen the cover sheet. Because if she'd seen the cover sheet, then like Woronowicz, she would have known that meant a call to voicemail. Because there's two of them. It matches the sheet perfectly. So the evidence Theora was using to show Gutierrez understood the records, I don't see a way it can be interpreted other than as proof she didn't have the cover sheet.
Yeah, I guess at this point it's probably appropriate because, Susan, you mentioned that one case that Theora was citing, the Klobicki case, because the Klobicki case is a case that the Supreme Court recently reversed. It was a case where Maryland courts had given a new trial to Klobicki, and it was based upon the defendant claiming ineffective assistance of counsel. This was a 1995 case, and it involved comparative bullet-lead analysis, CBLA, which was a technique which was used for many years to say, essentially, you could say that by comparing the lead in two different bullets that they came from the same package. And the defendant's claim was, at the time of my trial in 1995, the state's expert had taken part in a 1991 report. This wasn't part of discovery. It was simply a report that was out there. And that report called into question the validity of CBLA, and therefore that was ineffective assistance. And actually, as noted, the Maryland courts granted him relief. The Supreme Court reversed, and the reason they reversed was when they looked at that 1991 report, what they said was there were a few questions raised by that report, but overall, and I'm quoting from the opinion, the report itself did not question the validity of CBLA, concluding that it was a valid and useful forensic tool to match suspect to victim. And it wasn't until like 2003 that eventually CBLA started to fall out of favor. Presumably, Theora was trying to claim it's the same here as it was in the Klobicki case, but it's very much not so because that disclaimer in this case is explicitly saying incoming calls are not reliable for determining location, whereas the report, again, a report that was just floating out there, wasn't part of the case, did raise a few concerns, but the ultimate conclusion under that Frye-Reed standard in Maryland was this is still reliable, it's still a useful tool, and so very much that case, Klobicki, is distinguishable from the facts of this case.
Theora also put in the screen a copy of the documents that are related to the documents used at trials, Exhibit 31. And he talked about how it was admitted by stipulation, and therefore that's a point in Gutierrez's favor. I don't know. But, and I have my notes written in all caps when he did this. He puts on the screen, said it's common to take records and get a subset of them and make that subset into an exhibit. And there's no misconduct in that. See, look, here's the exhibit. And my notes have like in all frantic caps, wrong document. That's not Exhibit 31. Because that document has a little, what do you call it? A little fax line at the very top, the one that says sent to from number date. That document had it. The document that made Exhibit 31 didn't. And I talked about this a bit in the PCR live updates, but what Theer was trying to use as proof of the state's good faith is actually proof of, I don't know if it's intentional or not, but of still misconduct, because Theer was suggesting that because Exhibit 31 had the facts little top line thingy on it, technical term there, Gutierrez would have been on notice that this was a fax document. But here's what actually happened. And I'll put some documents up on the website so it's easier to see what's happening here. Yes, the cell phone records do have that top line thingy on them. And when Urich sent the subset of cell records to AT&T to get an affidavit from them authenticating them as actual AT&T records, he sent them a set that had the top line thingy. And that's what Teresa Kay, the security analyst and the affidavit signer, that's what she authenticated. That's what she said. These are real documents and real AT&T records. That is not what Urich put into evidence. Urich instead took an entirely different set of those same records, ones which someone had used a paper guillotine to cut off all the fax references, all the fax top line thingies, and he put that into the record as Exhibit 31. So in fact, the documents used at trial were not authenticated and had nothing on them that would have alerted Gutierrez to their origins as fax sheets. I don't think Theer was aware of that. I think he probably honestly believed that the Exhibit 31 documents used at trial had the top line thingy because that's what his documents have. But the record is very clear. We have the facts Urich sent to Teresa Kay, and it does have those top line thingies. And we have what she received, and it has the top line thingies. And Exhibit 31 doesn't have them. They were chopped off.
Was this the point at which he also kind of took a breath and said, let me defend Urich for just a bit right here?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he does say that he needs to just kind of get this out of his system type of thing. And you know, that I guess he thinks that we are also smearing Urich, but he wants to defend Kevin Urich. I can't remember exactly what he says. I just remember he said that he just needed to defend him or something like that.
Well, here's what I have in my notes. And this is another point where I'm like, did he really say that? So what I wrote down, Theer said, if the defense did not have the fax cover sheet, that's not a misstep by the state, just an oversight.
Right, so, which is a Brady violation.
Right.
So maybe he didn't say that because that doesn't make any sense at all. But there's parts of it where I know my notes were clear, and there's parts like this when I'm writing all over the place. So right. I'm fully willing to believe he didn't say that.
Yeah, I mean, there's literally, I think both of you have probably seen this, the Innocence Project just put up a quiz, and the first question on the quiz is, prosecutorial misconduct is defined as requiring intent by the prosecutor, and the answer is false because Brady and its progeny have all clearly said that intent is not required. Good faith or bad faith doesn't matter. If a decision by the prosecutor had unintended consequences and they were acting with the best of intentions, and for some reason they conveyed something confusingly or failed to convey it, that's a Brady violation.
And then he said, if I stop there, Justin Brown will call it just a technicality. So we also put Chad Fitzgerald on to explain why the records were reliable. I don't know entirely what Theer was referring to. It's not just a technicality to defeat a defendant's Brady claim by arguing it was only an oversight. So I don't know. But he said, oh, I want to dispose of any Brady issue regardless of what happened by showing it wasn't Brady in the first place. So it doesn't matter if it was disclosed or not. It was not good for the defense. But that didn't actually happen. He didn't actually present evidence of this at the PCR hearing, which we discussed last episode. This is where you talked about, too, about Urich.
Yeah, I see in your notes that he said that when Kevin Urich picked up the phone in April 2010 and spoke to Asia, that he wasn't thinking that, oh, no, this is the alibi witness we've always feared. He said that at the original PCR hearing, Urich only testified that, you know, Asia was concerned. Well, I mean, the real point he's trying to make is that it would have been misconduct if Asia, at the time she spoke with him, was already an actual witness in the case, and she wasn't. But to me, that's like a really odd circular argument because she wasn't, because he kind of prevented it from happening. She was being pursued as a witness in the case. I mean, that was the whole point of the contact with our private investigator and her. But he's saying, well, I mean, it's kind of interesting. I mean, in a way, he's kind of admitting that maybe he did dissuade her from coming, but it wouldn't have mattered because she wasn't a witness at the time anyways. How does that work, Colin? I mean, if a person is not yet a witness and the state prevents them from becoming one, does that mean that they're safe?
No, I mean, one of the main cases that Justin cited in support for the motion to reopen was Campbell versus State, which is Court of Special Appeals of Maryland, where the prosecutor essentially implied he wouldn't charge an alleged co-participant in a robbery if he decided not to become a witness and testify in support of Campbell, the defendant. And the court in that case found that that was improper and they ordered a new trial. And so that was, you know, it's a clear Maryland case where that person was not yet a witness. And in fact, the prosecutor's actions prevented him from being a witness and relief was granted to the defendant.
And another part where I thought I must have misheard, but then found out immediately after everyone else heard something I wrote down, was that Theo argued, oh, even at trial, Yurick didn't misrepresent what Asia told him. Because we just heard Asia testify now at the PCR hearing that, you know, she was a little bit irritated that she had to go out of her way to do all this when Robbie showed up at her door because she wanted to go see her boyfriend, but she did it anyway because it felt important. Maybe she conveyed that to Yurick when she talked to him on the phone as only writing an affidavit because of that irritation. Trying to say that even at the PCR hearing, Yurick hadn't misrepresented to the court what Asia told him. But as we'll get to on the rebuttal, this is another one of Theroux's disingenuous arguments, because that's not what happened.
It's also very helpful to the defense, because what that's clearly indicating to the court is that here's a reasonable scenario where Asia is never at all impugning the credibility of her alibi. I mean, the fact that Yurick acted properly or not, that's not really relevant in terms of whether relief is granted. That went to reopening. The question is, what's the credibility and veracity of Asia? And it seems in this, Theroux is acknowledging that Asia, in this case, never said she only wrote the affidavit under pressure and it was an illegitimate alibi.
Because this was a very, very long closing.
When we got back, I think I recall that's when the phone boards went up.
Oh, they came back up again.
They came back up again, the phone boards with the cell phone records on them.
The special highlighting by numbers that we all got to witness. And then Theroux started saying, how do you know which type of CDR the fax cover sheet applies to? I submit that you just read it. Semantics aside, which does it apply to? Subscriber activity report A or subscriber activity report B? You can't just slap subscriber activity on top of a document and then say that this cover sheet explains it. I was probably like about to jump on my seat at this point because, I mean, he's like implying that the defendant was the one who'd slapped subscriber activity on it and was trying to like pull a fast one over the court. But AT&T is the one slapping that title on there. So yes, you can say that if AT&T labels a document as subscriber activity, it is a subscriber activity report.
I wonder how he deals with, like, IKEA furniture with the instructions. He's like, this is bullshit. This doesn't apply to this piece of furniture. I'm not going to accept that. Who the hell do they think they are?
This is clearly not a belly bookshelf. Ugh. So, Theo then said, the common sense interpretation of the cover sheet is that it only applies to the subscriber activity report, the one from the 217 fax. And the state respectfully submits that a lawyer is only required to have that level of assessment of the evidence. And then my notes in the margin, WTF. I mean, no one wants to hire a lawyer who was only required to have a glance at it and say, yeah, that kind of fits assessment.
This is interesting because when he goes on, he says, you know, but an expert confirmed for us as well that it had to do with switches and not cell site data. It's like he's arguing every alternative he can, which I think to a certain extent is okay. In court, people do argue alternatives. But in this situation, it's like none of the alternatives even actually work.
Yeah. So then just to summarize a long segment of closing, here's where I've got go back to Kabuki Kabuki. And then I liked one of his lines. He said, the defense is searching for a needle in a haystack, a useless needle.
What was he referring to there?
I think the whole cell phone argument. And it's not that the state does not appreciate a good ruse, talking about the defense's arguments about the cell phone stuff. Terrific sleight of hand by the defense, but not a legitimate area of cross-examination. He had some good lines. Oh, and then finally, and this is like probably 2 hours in, he gets to the Asia alibi issue. He said that Gutierrez had information that the offer by the alibi witness was not credible, and in fact, it was risky to put Asia on the stand. And he says, well, Justin just said I was drumming up a conspiracy, but it's really much more simple. Put yourself in Gutierrez's shoes. Then he doubles down on the whole, the letters weren't written when they said they were written thing. And he says, Asia McClain testified the letters were written on March 2nd, but that letter was a little bit of a prescient magic trick. And he's talking about like things the letters refer to and the time when they're written. And he says, oh, it's impossible if these letters have been written before mid-March based on his theory about the subpoena thing. But the way he describes the letters is that he says things like, in quotes, this letter looks a little bit funny. But where on earth is a case law that says if something looks a little bit funny, you don't have to investigate it? Central Booking, Car Route, Lincoln Park, Fibers, 3 weeks. These are all things Fear talked about to show the letters were not written on March 2nd, but there's no evidence that any of these or all of these things are things that she easily could have known about at the very beginning of March. And none of them are things that would make sense to include in a later written letter. This perfect storm of a letter, he called it. I mean, he did have some good turns of phrases there. And then back to the floor stuff. And this part drove me crazy more than anything else. And I think it was, slimy doesn't sum it up. Theroux had to know what he was doing. And I found out later that Floor had actually, he had to leave for another appointment he had. So he had been at the closing before lunch, but he had to go do his real lawyer job stuff. So he was not there for this part. And he didn't hear where Theroux put on Chris Floor's notes on the screen. And these notes are from a meeting he had with Anon very early on, dated March 6th, so 5 days after he began representing him. And Theroux said, Chris Floor was asked about things that if the defendant wanted to get friends to help him, and then he talks about forging an alibi. He talks about, he didn't even say the Juwan issue. He called it Justin Adger. So I mix the names up, but I'm pretty sure, I mean, he definitely had been referring to Juwan. And he's saying that Floor helped Anon write to a friend requesting that Asia forge an alibi for him, which no attorney would ever do. If an attorney did do that, they should lose their license. I mean, he's outright accusing Floor of doing something that should cause him to no longer be an attorney and is massively unethical and probably illegal. And it's all based on a nonsensical interpretation of a to-do list that Chris wrote down.
I always marvel at kind of these things because I think if Anon wanted to falsify an alibi, he's going to ask Asia, who he barely knows, to do it. And he's going to do it like this through like three different people. And if this whole thing was a conspiracy, it was like the worst conspiracy in the world because he actually never reaches out to Asia and makes sure she testifies in court for him. It just, none of it makes sense. Just like it doesn't make sense that he would ask Jay to do what the state says he asked Jay to do. I mean, like just given the relationships in place. But yeah, this is really shameful. I mean, somebody like Chris Floor, who has like an unblemished record, highly respected attorney in Maryland, and he's suggesting something, I mean, just about as bad as it can get.
The actual notes, I mean, if you read them, it says, it talks about getting a self-addressed stamped envelope. There is no possible way. I've tried to like figure out how this could possibly even support what Theroux was saying, but there's no version of reality in which this would help carry out the scheme that Theroux is proposing. It just doesn't. You don't use self-addressed stamped envelopes to send out to someone when you're in jail.
It's nonsensical. It's not the way you'd go about it. And at the same time that he's criticizing the supposed attacks on Gutierrez and Yurik, it's almost unimaginable that he is accusing Floor of taking part in this. And we saw there was blowback because he did the same thing with Milliman, and that led to Milliman reaching out to Judge Welch and complaining about all the misrepresentations in that front. So yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate that these arguments got made, but I don't really see them moving the needle at all in terms of Judge Welch's opinion.
Yeah, and then after, you know, throwing out this really, really serious accusation, Theroux says, is that what happened here? I don't know. It's a theory. He says, I don't know. It's a theory. The state doesn't need to prove it. It just needs to show that a reasonable attorney would have looked at the letters and concluded something wasn't right, that contacting Asia was just a bad idea. Well, the state does need to put forward an actual reason. Conjecture is not a substitute for strategy. And his closing was so against the weight of the case law. When you have so much case law that says, basically, I don't know, it's a theory, cannot rebut these kind of claims on post-conviction hearings, why would you add that in your closing? You're admitting that all you have is a theory. You're admitting all you have is conjecture.
Right. The fact that he kept hammering on Klobicki, which does relate to the cell tower issue, but in his briefs, in his arguments, in everything, he's never cited a single case that deals with a court finding effective assistance despite failure to contact an alibi witness. I mean, it speaks volumes. And when Judge Welch is sitting down and writing his opinion, he's going to have to rely upon precedent. And Susan, you couldn't even keep up with all the cases that Justin was citing. And they're from the same jurisdiction. They deal with similar factual issues. It's just really tough to see how anything that Theroux said during closing is going to be at all meaningful without case law to back it up.
So at one point, the judge is like, are we getting close? Which is not what you want to hear. And Theroux says, we are, Your Honor. Theroux then tries to explain why they called Officer Steve and brought up the Drew Davis invoice and the fact that he went to talk to security guard Steve and the track coach immediately after being brought on as the defense investigator. But again, since Theroux's theory is that the Asia letters were written like weeks later, if not a month or so later or longer, well, there's no possible universe in which Davis was investigating the Asia letters, because according to Theroux, they don't exist. So those two points, his like two versions of a mic drop moment, are radically different and cannot be reconciled. Here's another one of those disingenuous arguments State made. Theroux argued, Asia McClain is not helpful to the defense because she is getting Adnan away from his routine. She is the iron that wrinkles out the State's case. In other words, as he tries to explain, defendant's routine was well established. Gutierrez knew this. So why would he have gone out of his way to check email at a different library? Your Honor, I have some appreciation for the argument regarding the defendant going to the library, but the defendant does not make it. He then puts a memo on the screen, and Theroux says, the defendant does not say library. He talks about getting a call from Hayes' brother and other things, but Mr. Syed's attorney knew that Syed could not recall anything like going to the library. Why would Mr. Syed not include this information about the library in his memo from August? In my margin notes, diff memo, ! But according to Theroux, Asia was a witness for the state because she could have been used to show what Adnan was really doing that day, because she shows that Adnan wasn't abiding by his usual routine. Basically was saying if the state had known about Asia, their case would have been stronger. She could have fixed the problem in their case, which is how the hell did Adnan get in Hayes' car? They couldn't answer that. They couldn't figure it out because there's no evidence of it and no way it makes sense.
And this sleight of hand requires the state to now say that, oh, actually, we believe Asia.
Yeah. And ignoring the fact that, like, also it's saying, oh, wait, Asia's totally right. We're just making all this stuff up because we felt like it. But actually, Asia was 100% correct, and she's our weapon. Theroux said, I'm sorry to end with this, but I have to say it. Asia McClain is a charming woman, and there may be a kernel of truth to her story, or a kernel of her story that is credible, because the defendant may have gone to the library and met up with the victim there. So Asia McClain is not a weapon for the defense. It's a weakness in their case. Asia irons out the wrinkles in the state's case, and to restore faith in the system, to restore faith that the defendant received a fair trial, we don't evaluate these questions through the convenient lens of hindsight.
I want to throw up.
I mean, I was really frustrated because, I mean, one, there's the factual inaccuracies. Two, there's the fact that my notes were getting messed up because he kept numbering things that didn't actually match his arguments. And then three, he's accusing attorneys of all kinds of misconduct. The fourth thing is that his closing moment and his powerful, and by the end, he was giving a very solid performance in terms of a closing, in terms of like the style, but urging the court not to view things through a convenient lens of hindsight after he just portrayed all kinds of events through a very, very convenient lens of hindsight. That's all the state's arguments were. It's all its closing was. And if the court isn't going to view things through the convenient lens of hindsight, the state didn't really put anything on at all.
This is kind of like my point of departure, I think, between my assessment of the prosecutor and you, Susan. I mean, in an earlier episode on the PCR, I said, you know, what makes me really upset about this is I refuse to believe somebody who is, I mean, this is like Harvard-Yale guy, right? Like, we know he's bright. that you thought that, you know, he maybe actually believes what he's saying. Whereas I'm like, I refuse to believe that he believes what he's saying. The reason I refuse to believe it is because which version of events does he believe? Like, does he believe Aja's lying? Does he believe she was mistaken? Does he believe it was a conspiracy? Does he believe she actually saw it all? But Gutierrez realized, oh my God, she's going to be a brilliant witness for the defense somehow. And Gutierrez knew almost nothing because the state wouldn't give her anything. They wouldn't give her Jay's statements, Jen's statements. All Gutierrez knew at the time that Adnan raised the fact that Aja could be an alibi was that TV reports said that Hay disappeared shortly after 3 p.m. So how could she not investigate? So that's why when I said, you know, I want to throw up, I feel sick. I'm upset because I believe that Thiru knows he's being disingenuous, that he knows that all of these things can exist at the same time. So which one is it? I don't think he believes any of it. I think he just wants to maintain his conviction. But maybe I'm a little more harsh in my judgment about him than others might be.
Well, I don't even know. Part of me hopes if he's going to make the kind of accusations he did, that he actually has a subjective belief in them.
And then it was time for Justin's rebuttal to the state's closing arguments.
Justin went through and started off just saying, I'd like to remind the court of why we're here, of what happened, what the procedural history is. We're not here because of dumb luck, he told the court. We're not here because of some popularity contest like the state's arguing. We are here for real legal reasons that have been ongoing for years now. And that's what the court should be hearing. The court isn't here simply to rubber stamp the prior appellate decisions and say, oh, look, faith is restored. It's here to consider these very real factual questions. And a good point Adelaide made was that prejudice and evaluating prejudice as a second prong of Strickland, prejudice is not putting all of the state's evidence on one side of the scale and putting Aja on the other. It's whether there's a reasonable probability that it could have affected the outcome. Had Gutierrez effectively used Aja as an alibi witness, knowing what we know now? And remember, Aja isn't just the Aja alibi. Aja points to two other alibi witnesses. So it's not just Gutierrez's failure to call Aja that's a problem here. It's a failure to talk to Aja and learn about the names of the other two witnesses and to get them involved. Justin said, talking about the whole argument that Thera made about how diligent Gutierrez was because she wrote dozens of discovery letters. She did. She was all over trying to be like, give me discovery, stop withholding it. And Justin said, I'm blown away, and I agree with Thero. That's a lot of discovery requests. But that just doesn't matter at all. No witness has ever said that a measure of an attorney's ability is the number of letters she's written to the state requesting discovery. And this is when Justin started to attack some of the factual misstatements that Thero made. He talked about Yurik. We just heard in the courtroom, Thero was saying, Yurik was, he wasn't lying to the court. He was just paraphrasing what Aja told him, because Aja may have told him that she was feeling kind of annoyed on the day in question when someone came to the door and interfered with her plans to go see her boyfriend. But as Justin said, being annoyed is very different from saying that she was pressured into writing the affidavit. Those aren't the same things at all. This isn't something you can excuse away by saying, oh, he was just saying what Aja told him, because what Yurik said is not what Aja said. And if you believe Aja, then Yurik lied to the court. And Justin said, when Kevin Yurik doesn't come to the court to refute that, I wonder about it. We all wonder about it, because what we know is that it means strategically the state felt it was better off not trying to rebut what Aja said. And you can draw your own conclusions from that. And he said, this whole Aja thing, it's the most convoluted theory I've ever heard from the prosecution. And then he quoted Thero, I don't know, it's a theory.
Actually, it wasn't that he said this is the entire state's argument, basically. He picked up a piece of paper like he was going to read out something really tremendous and goes, it's a theory. That's it. That's all there was. To me, Justin looked really frustrated right then.
Yeah, he said, and that was one man standing in this courtroom coming up with a theory that would let him get out of this hearing without calling his own witnesses. Because none of this came from a witness. It came from a prosecutor in closing arguments. So other than Thero's allusions to things that aren't actually in the defense file, the state didn't put on a case for any of this. And I think the best issue that Justin pointed out was Thero's whole argument about how, well, Adnan didn't make this argument. If Adnan had been in the library, went there all the time, and happened to see Aja that day, why didn't he tell his attorneys this? So Justin takes the projector himself and puts up the notes from the July meeting with Adnan. And he says, Thero just told you that this was a break from Anand's routine, that Gutierrez would have been concerned about Asia because they showed that Adnan was not following his normal everyday routine and that this was dangerous. Well, look at these notes. And they say Asia and boyfriend saw him in library 2:15 to 3:15, went to library often. I mean, this is one of the very basic documents in this case in the hearing. It says very plainly, Asia saw me in the library right after school. I went to the library often. But that doesn't help Theo's case. So he tried to spin it by presenting a different memo and telling the court, Your Honor, if Adnan really did this regularly, he would have told his attorney that, but he didn't. So we can assume that he's now lying.
Yeah, there are multiple references to Asia in the notes implying that he had brought her up multiple times.
And that he did so in the context of, I often went to the library after school and that's when I saw her. But Theo's whole position is that Asia shows Adnan breaking his routine, and therefore it was reasonable for Gutierrez not to call her. But the notes themselves show what was his routine. So it was just an example of just how far afield from the facts these conspiracies were.
Yeah, and then, I mean, Rabia, going back to your question from before about whether Thiru actually believes his theory or whether it's somewhat disingenuous, this isn't the first time that people have raised questions about the arguments that Thiru has made during a closing statement. Specifically, there is a case from a few years ago out of Baltimore City. It was the murder of Ralph Hall, and Thiru was one of the prosecutors in the case. He was joined by Patricia McLean, another state ASA. And their theory was that Michael Hayes was a former business partner of Hall who wanted him dead. And so he hired Derek Toomer to kill Hall. And then the claim is that Toomer in turn hired George Johnson to serve as the hitman. And then that Toomer would pick him up after the shooting, which took place in a car. And after that shooting, they went to the scene of the car to recover samples from which they could get DNA profiles. And to go into a bit of the science on this, sort of go back to biology in high school, human beings have 46 chromosomes. Those are divided into 23 pairs. In turn, those chromosomes are made up of genes. And genes, in turn, those are made up of things called alleles. And you basically get one allele from your mother, one from your father. So, for instance, eye color, you might get the brown eye color allele from your father, the blue from your mother. And because the brown allele is dominant, you would have brown eyes. And we go to DNA testing. FBI and other agencies use CODIS. That stands for the Combined DNA Index System. And what they do is they use 13 loci or locations, where essentially when they get samples from a murder scene and they draw blood from the defendant, they're comparing the alleles at 13 different locations. And the question is, how many matches do you have in those 13 locations to be able to include someone as the source of DNA? And then how many matches on the low end would be able to exclude that person? And the debate is over whether you require 9 or 10. So there was a study out of Arizona a few years ago where they looked at 65,000 felons, and they found that 122 of those felons matched on 9 of 13 loci, whereas only 20 matched on 10 of 13. And the question is, do you have to be a match on 10, or is 9 good enough? Now, in this case, a few of the samples taken from the car were matches for Johnson, which is unsurprising. The state's theory is that he was the shooter and was in the car. And on the other hand, Toomer was excluded as the sample of all of the DNA found in the car, except for one location. It was on the passenger side. And the expert for the state was Ms. Ingreiten. And what she said was, for this one sample, Toomer was a match at 8 locations, which means he couldn't be excluded as the source of that DNA, but he also couldn't be included. And so, in other words, not enough information to say whether he was the source of that DNA or not. It wasn't Theo who gave the initial closing statement. It was his co-counsel, Patricia McLean. And in her closing statement, she says, George Johnson knew he didn't have to go very far because he knew Toomer was going to help him wipe down that car. And there's evidence of that wiping down. How do we know that? And Toomer, in his attempt to wipe down the car, was wiping away some of his DNA, but not all of it, because the DNA cannot exclude Toomer from being in that vehicle. Now, the thing is, and this was pointed out by defense counsel in defense counsel's closing is that actually Ingraton said there was no evidence whatsoever that could establish that someone tried to wipe down the DNA in the car. And so this was just a completely made up argument. And defense counsel also said in this case, it was disingenuous to claim that the DNA kind of pointed toward tumor when in fact the evidence showed he couldn't be included, but he also couldn't be excluded. Then it got to Theroux, and Theroux gave rebuttal closing. And I'm reading some of the excerpts from what he said during rebuttal closing. He said, "Common sense tells you that tumor is the one who picked Mr. Johnson up, but the DNA also points at tumor because there is one spot where they didn't erase the evidence well enough, where tumor left enough evidence that he couldn't be excluded." Then continuing down, and then the detective continues to investigate. He finds out the DNA points to George Johnson and tumor. The DNA corroborates it. Just a massive coincidence that George Johnson's DNA is present in the pockets and on the steering wheel, and that tumor's DNA can't be excluded from the passenger armrest. Okay, so that's the argument that's made by Theroux, and you get the sense that this is completely mischaracterizing and misrepresenting the evidence. And on appeal, that is exactly what the Court of Special Appeals of Maryland finds. They find, A, there's no evidence of wiping down that was made up by Theroux in rebuttal closing. B, it was completely improper to say the DNA evidence pointed to tumor. And so reading from the court's opinion, twice in rebuttal argument, the prosecutor, Theroux, argued that the DNA pointed to tumor, even though there was no DNA evidence pointing to tumor at all. Several other times, the prosecutor theorized that appellant's DNA could not be excluded from the sample because he did not do a good enough job wiping it away. Not only was there no evidence that tumor wiped away any DNA, Ms. Ingraton testified she could not draw such a conclusion, the prosecutor's argument took Ms. Ingraton's statement that appellant could not be excluded and turned it on its head. The prosecutor was saying essentially that appellant's DNA was included in the sample initially, but because he tried to wipe it away, the expert was able to determine only that tumor could not be excluded. The prosecutor misrepresented the evidence, creating a picture in which tumor, complicit in the crime, attempted to erase the evidence, and in the final line, the prosecutor's argument had no basis in fact. That gives you a pretty good idea of the strangeness and the oddness of what you see with Theroux's closing argument. When you look at this case, if you think this is generally what you're going to see in a PCR hearing or a trial, it's not at all like that. And the way the court characterizes this just nails it in the sense that everything that Theroux was saying in the tumor case, much of what he was saying in this case, it wasn't based on fact. It was theories, it was unsupported, and it's troubling, frankly, when someone from the Attorney General's office in a state such as Maryland is making these arguments because, I don't know, was Toomer guilty? Was he innocent? We don't know. But because of these misrepresentations at trial, he very well could have put an innocent man behind bars. And if it were a guilty person, it led to that conviction being overturned.
And Theroux knew completely that you cannot simply wipe up a few loci from a DNA sample. It doesn't happen. When you clean up DNA, you clean it up. They wouldn't find a sample there. But you can't simply pick out a few of the loci they're going to test and, you know, take them out so they're not available for matching. The way he presented it and the way any reasonable person would have understood it is that they tried to wipe it away, so they didn't find samples in a lot of places, but they didn't do a good enough job of cleaning up. So they found a sample of his, a small one somewhere. But no, what actually happened here is they found partial samples of DNA with a few of the loci matching up to tumor. But scientifically, that is not evidence that it was tumor's DNA. There was no matching to tumor. His DNA was not found there. And this isn't just a matter of like some kind of like scientific fine print. No, it's actually a real problem because basically, scientifically, it does mean something. There is not a match. With a mixed sample like this, there is subjective interpretation that goes into understanding it. And the scientists mean what they say when they say they cannot link this sample here to the suspects because the data does not allow that kind of linking. And Theroux wanted to brush by that and to turn something that was very much saying there is no evidence this is tumor's DNA into this is tumor's DNA.
Yeah, and in fact, as I sort of hinted at before, the theory of the case was that Johnson killed Hall in his car and that tumor thereafter picked him up and never entered the car. So this theory where he eventually turns it into, oh, his DNA's in the car and he wiped it away, actually is inconsistent with the state's evidence in theory, which is that tumor was never in the car. And by the way, Johnson, the person who allegedly committed the crime, he is currently appealing his conviction. He's represented actually by Julie Remy, who was one of the clerks working for Gutierrez back in 1999. And just as I said, very similar in terms of how the closing arguments involve some off-the-wall theories and factual misrepresentations in both cases. In the Johnson case, the claim is in part that Theroux tried to create this dog and pony show of putting Toomer on the stand so that he would have to exercise his Fifth Amendment privilege, creating a certain inference to the jury. There are also claims of Brady violations in that case. So, you know, I don't know whether that appeal is going to be successful or not, but those were two linked cases, a pretty horrific murder. And at least in one case, the misrepresentations led to the conviction being thrown out. We'll see what happens in the Johnson case. But a lot of the conduct, this courtroom theatrics, this almost making a novel out of case and trying to extrapolate facts that aren't there, it's very indicative of this is the way that he operates in the courtroom.
As Justin finished up on his rebuttal argument and his very last statements to the court, this case would have looked very different if someone other than Theroux had vouched for these facts. But with the exception of Chad Fitzgerald, that podium, the witness stand, looks exactly the same now as it did during the state's case. Empty.
Not a single day goes by in which I don't get multiple messages, texts, tweets from lots of different people asking, when do we think the judge is going to make a ruling in the hearing? And the truth is that we don't know. It's been almost exactly 2 months since the PCR in February. And while that may seem like a long time to some folks, in the legal space-time continuum, it's really just a blip. Last time, it took him 14 months. Now, of course, this is a bit of a different situation because he's retired. As far as we know, he has no other case on his docket. But we do have to remember that there are a lot of eyes on this case, and also that it was sent down from the Court of Special Appeals. So he knows whatever ruling he's going to issue is going to get a lot of scrutiny, both in the public and by the higher court. It's better if he takes his time and he gets it right, is what he's probably thinking. It's hard to wait, I know. I get a lot of messages also asking me, are we having a tough time waiting? Is it very stressful for Adnan and his family and me and his supporters? And the truth is, it's not. Because we waited 17 years for this chance. And Justin and his team delivered in spades. 17 years is a long time to wait. A few more months is not a big deal. Especially because I, at least, feel very positive about the hearing. I think it couldn't have gone much better, to be honest. What I found really interesting about the state's approach was that over and over again, the prosecutor brought up his admiration for Christina Gutierrez. And in many respects, to me, it seemed like he was kind of channeling her methods, right? Just like her, he didn't really put on any witnesses that really helped the case, or at least their side of the case. He didn't cite much precedent. He did manage to win a lot of the objections and motions, and that might have been good on the surface for him, but on the other hand, if he has to appeal this ruling, for example, if the judge rules in our favor, well, he can't really raise a lot of those objections because they were all ruled in his favor, nearly all of them, in fact. So in a way, that could also work for us. This, of course, is not the last you're going to be hearing about Adnan's case from our team. But I do want to say thank you on behalf of the Undisclosed team for the millions of you who've been following the case, who have been with us. It's been a year now since we began Undisclosed. And here we are at the end of our coverage of his post-conviction appeal. Of course, we still have to wait for the ruling. We still have to see where it goes from there. And we're going to be covering it every step of the way. So don't worry about that. But beyond Adnan's case, there are lots of other things on our minds. Like many of you, we have been thinking and talking about other criminal justice stories that have been very popular in the media and news lately, from Making a Murderer to the People versus OJ to the great podcast that's created by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution called Breakdown. And we're going to be coming back to you very soon to talk about all of these different cases, to talk about other issues in criminal justice, as we are preparing to launch season 2, which is going to come this summer. And as many of you might know, I recently finished the manuscript for the book that's going to be about Adnan's case, to which he's contributed quite a bit as well, and that's going to be coming out in September. But you can pre-order it, and you can find more details about that on adnansstory.com. But this story isn't over, and we have lots more stories to tell. Next time on Undisclosed. Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Our production consultant is Rebecca Lavoie. She's a true crime author and hosts the podcast Crime Writers on Serial. Dennis Robinson is our producer, and you can find us online on social media on both Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.